Liz Winstead says she dreamed of entering the priesthood when she was a child, but instead she has succeeded in a field that is nearly as male-dominated, comedy. She was the co-creator and head writer of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. She was one of the founders of Air America Radio, and she fills clubs around the country as a stand-up comedian. She's just published a collection of personal essays called Liz Free or Die. It's from Riverhead, and I'm very pleased to welcome Liz Winstead back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, why did you want to become a priest when you were little? Don't most Catholic girls want to become nuns?
The nuns didn't seem to have as much fun to me. It was one of those things where brought up Catholic, youngest of five kids, and youngest by a lot of years. So there was five very loud children and two very loud parents. And so trying to get a word in edgewise was nearly impossible. And so the only people I was sort of exposed to in my little tiny world were rock stars and priests. And I would watch a priest. He would get up there. He would give his sermon. And then everybody would be rapt. And no one interrupted him when he spoke. So that was really, it wasn't really the message so much as it was the medium seemed interesting.
And the male-female thing didn't occur to you?
No, well, I never saw nuns holding attention the way the priests did. And so it didn't occur to me that girls couldn't be priests. I just assumed that the road to priesthood was altar boy. That's what I assumed, foolishly.
So is there a connection with that and your decision many years later that your true calling was comedy? Because priests, most priests, I have met some funny priests, but most priests do not really go for laughs when they're giving their sermons.
No, they certainly don't. I don't know if it might have been a crazy road. I think the stage and the having people bringing you stuff on the sides, you had assistants, you had a stage, you were amplified. I think the whole congregational performance was really cool to me. So I think in sort of searching for where I'm going to put my voice, I certainly did realize, yeah, I'm not necessarily maybe in an ensemble, but I kind of kept the one person, somebody please listen to me thing, which I think eventually I figured out was stand-up.
But when you start with stand-up, you don't always get the kind of attention and respect that a priest gets.
You don't. And the craziest thing about developing in stand-up is that you have to develop an act and a sense of confidence at the same time. So while you're bombing miserably, you've got to figure out a way to get up and do it again.
Priests don't have flop sweat.
They don't. They might. Maybe, you know, who knows? They wear a lot of, when you wear that many clothes, you can't really tell. I think that's the secret.
So what happened to you the first time you were on stage, open mic night in Minneapolis in 1983?
Oh, well, it was an interesting thing because stand-up hadn't occurred to me to do as a woman in her 20s. Because the women I saw doing it were older women, Phyllis Diller, Toni Fields, and they were talking about their lives, which were their deadbeat husbands, you know, the link that their boobs had sort of descended to the relationship to their bodies, and being a housewife and stuff. And then it was just men, and then the rest was men, talking about sort of men things. And so I remember watching George Carlin with a friend of mine. She said, you should go try this, and I never thought I could. And so I went and I watched for the first time before I actually hit stage. And I remember feeling like I was in a magical place. It was tiny club chairs and tables pushed together, and people were smoking, and everybody was really excited to watch this thing that was going on stage. And it was a really small brick-walled club, and people wanted to hear something that was going to be groundbreaking. And it felt like if you weren't in that room that night, that you were missing out. And I caught that bug, and so when I went back to actually try it for my first time, cut to maybe it was a month and a half later, there was maybe half a room full. And it wasn't that Saturday night crowd. And it was mostly friends of all of the other acts. And I got up there, and it's almost like a blackout where you're just hoping that you can remember what you're going to say, that you will get a laugh. The audience, you couldn't see at all. It was pitch black. So the only reason or way that I would know if they were there was if I made them laugh. And so I think my jokes were terrible. I mean, just awful jokes like, you know, if you ever play Monopoly with bald guys, they always pick the hat. You know, just horrible observational.
You were writing your own material?
Writing my own material. And with no order, with no timing, just kind of spitting it out as much as I could. Another big hit was, have you ever noticed that male Great Danes should have to wear underwear in public? That was a big one.
Did you get laughs on those lines?
I did get laughs. And most of the time when you're on stage for your first time, you do, because your adrenaline drives you. But then you're like, oh, I kind of got enough laughs to try it again. So then I went on the second time, bombed miserably. So now you're 50-50. So then you're like, do I do it again? Well, I have to see if I'm good or bad. Third time you go on, you're like, well, I was sort of okay, so I can't really judge that, so I have to do it again. And then it becomes an addiction.
But most people are imitating somebody else when they start. Who were your influences?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that most comics you talk to will talk about this fascination they had with stand-up comedy kind of throughout their whole lives. And I really wasn't that person.
So you didn't love Lenny Bruce and then Carlin?
I didn't. I was just searching for a way to be able to say something uninterrupted.
Well, but your life was a mess. You write the you got pregnant the first time you had sex.
Yes.
You were 17 at the
yes.
time. And you were a Catholic.
Yes.
And that means...
That means you make all sorts of stupid Catholic girl decisions about... You know, the thing about sexuality that's interesting and unfortunate is that oftentimes we get a sex drive before we get any common sense. And so that weighs in, and then your friends are an influence, and I was Catholic. And so in deciding whether or not I was going to have sex, I did a very Catholic thing where I weighed out my sinning options, and I said, well, if I have sex and use birth control, I would be committing two sins. So I opted for one sin, and because I'm a real brainiac, chose the more fun sin, which, of course...
leads to another sin.
Leads to another sin in some cases, yes.
As you reveal.
As I reveal. Indeed, I do.
I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Well, it's...
How did your parents react?
My parents, they didn't know until... I terminated the pregnancy, but I don't really talk about that so much in the book, only because the bigger thing for me was being lost and pregnant and 17 and seeing an ad on a bus for something called, the ad simply said, free pregnancy tests, choices, options. And it was a crisis pregnancy center. And it was, when I walked in, there was a woman who was in a lab coat with a clipboard. So I'm 17, she looked like a doctor. But she wasn't, you know, it was like, oh, the Lancome people wear that coat too, right. And so she was a fundamentalist Christian. I ended up at one of those places where they try to convince you that you should have a baby no matter what, without asking you anything about you or anything. And she scared me. They showed me big pictures in a book of various stages of fetuses, and she basically would fudge language that was very interesting, where she would say things like, I asked about abortion. And she said, abortion's against our law. And this was in 1977. And I was like, against our law? I thought it was legalized in 1973. And then I get our law. Oh, she meant her religious law. But my ears, like, now I think I'm a criminal and I'm pregnant and I'm about to commit another sin. But at least it wasn't three sins because I didn't use birth control. Running through my brain, not knowing what to do. And I told her I needed time to think. And this is... She was very happy to hear that. But when I walked out the door, she looked at me and she said, remember, Liz, your choices are mommy or murder. And I remember walking out of there thinking, those can't be my only choices. And that woman doesn't know me at all, because if she did, she would never, ever want to encourage me to become a mother.
Now, you couldn't use this as material for your stand-up.
I can use it for... It's interesting. You can use it for material in monologues, but not in stand-up. Parts of the book, I would say, I could totally read in a comedy club. Parts of the book, I could not. You know,
yeah, but you could do... So many comics are now doing these one-person shows.
Yeah, that could, and any of my stories could definitely live in one of those.
You're right that the first Gulf War and media coverage of it changed you as a comedian. You became political?
I became political. I kind of transitioned from... I had always had politics and been a person paying attention to politics, but never did introduce it into my act. Mostly because I just felt like I wasn't clear myself or developed myself enough to understand that when you have a point of view that's strong, as you maybe people will say, I don't like what you think or I don't believe what you think, you also develop an incredibly strong fan base of people who do. And if you play things right and you're questioning politicians and the media as a whole, both people on both sides of the aisle can come along for the
ride. So you became an instant success. You became one of the most famous comics in America as a result.
Clearly, everyone's at the end. People are pulling over to the side of the road in their cars right now. They cannot believe you're speaking with me. No, it was tragic. You know, because show business, they couldn't care less about politics. You know, they were like, why do you want to do this? This seems hard. And I said, I don't know that I even want to do it. I feel like I don't have a choice. You know, after seeing that first Gulf War, I was on this horrible blind date with a guy who I invited to see La Dolce Vita. And my first clue should have been when he said,
first
isn't
mistake.
That... He actually said to me, isn't that in black and white? And I should have just said, you know what, dude, this isn't happening. So we went to a bar afterwards because I'm from Minnesota and heaven forbid I just end something that's going horribly wrong. I have to continue it because we're nice. And the first Gulf War, it was the first night it was on TV. And there was theme song and graphics and this green light. And I remember thinking, are they trying to sell me a war? Or are they reporting on a war? And at that moment, my dopey date goes, this is so cool. And I thought, oh, my God, how I've not been paying attention to how great they can manipulate us all.
So you started incorporating that into your act. And then you came to New York?
I was in New York then.
Oh.
Yeah. I was in New York then.
Well, how did you wind up at the creating the Daily Show in 1996?
Well, what happened was once I started on this journey of responding and paying attention to the media and the news, I had become fairly successful in doing that. It took a really long time, but I had a one-woman show that was pretty successful. There was an election year that came up in 92 that was kind of elevated me up a little bit, and some folks at Comedy Central and MTV had paid attention. I ended up working on Jon Stewart's syndicated show before he started hosting The Daily Show. And
yeah, but the Daily Show...
He was not the original host.
Yeah, it was Craig Kilborn.
Craig Kilborn, yes. So I had met Madeline Smithberg. We actually moved into the same apartment building at the same time, and she was the producer of Jon's show. So she invited me along to come in and produce on Jon's show. And then when we got canceled, we were going to go in and pitch to Comedy Central this wacky, bad idea show. And we got done pitching our wacky show. And they said, you know what? That's real cute. We want to do a show that responds to the world. There hasn't really been one on in a while. And I was like, oh, my God. I've been spending the last 4 years of my life responding to the media, doing one-woman shows, politics, the media, all together. And I said to them, you know, the one thing I think would be awesome that no one's really done before in doing political satire is we should become what we are making fun of. Let's be a comedy show that acts like a newsroom. And we let the audience have a brain and they'll come along for the ride. And they said, let's do it. They gave us a year to develop it. And hence The Daily Show was born.
Liz Winstead's book of essays is called Liz Free or Die. So you put together the kinds of writers you'd expect there. And then at one point early on, you had to tell them to stop inviting their drug dealer to the office. It sounds more like a college dorm room than like a serious cable television show.
Well, let me tell you, it's when you go from performer writer to performer writer in charge of your friends. For me, I was so obsessed with the fact that they were going to think I was one of the suits. Liz, you've become one of them. So I was trying to always play fair and work in a democracy, which, of course, comedy is not a democracy. And so it was literally day two or three where this mushroom dealer was coming up to the door. And I had to – Madeline said, Liz, you've got to tell them that we can't have mushroom dealers coming to the offices. And I was like, oh, my God, okay. So I call all the writers into my office and I was like, you guys, you know, I hate to be, you know, come down on you. But if you're going to meet your mushroom dealer, you've got to meet them at the diner two blocks down.
Mushrooms are, right?
That was my big compromise.
But you didn't stay all that long. Were you the only woman in a real executive position here?
No, my gosh, no. The executive producer was a woman and co-creator, Madeline Smithberg. I was the head writer. The executive in charge of production was a woman. We had three women field producers, two women producers, supervising producer. Yeah, we had a lot of women. Just not on the writing staff. We also only had six writers when we started instead of the 12 they have now.
Then December 1997, Craig Kilborn was suspended for making sexist remarks about you and Esquire.
Yes, he was.
Now, why do you think he said that stupid thing?
He you know what? I never talk about it, and I can't get into Craig's head. And so that's a question for Craig, I think.
He said
for me.
That you had sexual desires toward him. I don't know how else to say this.
Well, I think you just said it. He did say that, and I didn't. I didn't.
So you left because of that? Because he was suspended, but John Stewart wasn't his immediate replacement, was he?
Yeah, John Stewart was his immediate replacement. Yep. John Stewart took over the show about, I guess I want to say 6 months or 8 months, about 6 months after I left. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And had you thought of returning?
John had asked me to come back on a couple of different occasions. What I thought was, since this is a success, why not get more shows like this on the air? And so I thought, and when he asked me back, I was like, you kind of got this one, dude. Like, you really know, I would just be overkill. Why not spread the good cheer out there? And it was difficult because the one thing that about these shows that is the downside is that there's no monetizing back end. You know, you can't syndicate it forever. They don't have a shelf life.
Now, you then later became one of the founding vice presidents at Air America Radio,
yes,
working with Rachel Maddow and Chuck D. Now, I remember the rumors at that time that some of the hosts were being paid exorbitant salaries for a startup, and there were predictions of doom from the beginning.
I mean, I think some of the key players were being paid a ton of money. I think more to the point, the promise that there was this sort of long-term, we can bankroll this and actually develop it, promise of money from the people who hired us all, turned out not to be true. And so we were all working in this environment that quickly revealed itself to be a financial house of cards. The cool thing about it was that when that happened, no one quit. Everybody stayed. It was very important for all of the producers and talent to stay there and to provide this other voice in this talk show wilderness that had been dominated by conservative radio.
Well, why do you think it didn't succeed? One criticism was that it was too obsessed with people like Rush Limbaugh and didn't create its own unique environment.
Well, I would disagree that it had anything to do with the talent, because every single person that was on that initial broadcast, Mark Maron is the number one podcast in the country. Rachel Maddow is Rachel Maddow. Al Franken's a senator. Randy Rhodes is still on the radio. And Sam Cedar has an amazing podcast. And Janine Garofalo is a great success. So I would argue that it had nothing to do with the talent. And it had everything to do with the fact that there was no money to keep it going. That was what happened. You know, the stations that were initially there.
And then lost carriage.
Yeah, they lost carriage. That was it.
But meanwhile, you're out there still doing comedy.
We're all out there
doing
it.
Is it better for you now than it was when you started?
You know what's great is whenever you have the longevity of developing who you are and developing a fan base, then people know to look for you when you come. The crowds are fun. I'm having a great time.
And now you've written a book.
And now I've written this book.
Uh-huh. So you expect to build a different fan base of readers?
I think I'll build a different fan base of readers. And what's fun about this is my stand-up is really politically and socially charged, and it's very up to the minute. So to be able to have a book that is it tints in politics, for sure, you'll get who I am, but they're really rich, fun, interesting stories.
Well, it's interesting that when I think of political humor, I usually think of men. I think of women doing other kinds of comedy. Are you the exception to the rule, or has it changed for women now?
I think there's some of us out there. I think that, you know, you have to do political humor, you really have to have a burning desire in your gut to, A, execute it well. You want to be smart. You want to make sure that you're asking through your comedy, furthering the dialogue rather than just always being snarky. You want to be able to make a point and ask questions and have people leave going, huh. Let's talk about that act over dinner.
Well, that's what Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are doing now. And then they're kind of children of your legacy. Liz Winstead, her book, Liz Free or Die, it is published by Riverhead. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.